Thank you, Caroline. I am not David Wagner, despite the what you saw up there. Dave will come next. But what I'd like to talk about is some ongoing discussion that has been conducted in the Caddis Fly community for quite some time now. And just the arrows. Yeah, that works. This illustration out of Grimaldi and Ingalls' text is a good way to show in one picture just some of the incredible diversity of architectural production that caddis flies have exhibited and has been a source of fascination for people for a very long time. And recently, Glenn Wiggins, 2005, published this book on the underwater architects, in which he summarized really much of his life's work and captured in one concise location much of the diversity about caddis fly architecture. You might find it worthwhile yourself. Glenn, perhaps more than anyone else, has been successful in recognizing five major groups of caddis flies. The free-living caddis flies, the Rhycophalloidea, with two families, all of which are free-living predators, engulfers. They pursue their strategy. They're not lie-in-wait strategists, but they're pursuing their prey. And they pupate in a dome of mostly sand and stones that is serves as a shelter. Then inside this, they spin a semi-permeable cocoon that is distended by organic exudates that they release inside the cocoon and creates a positive or osmotic pressure to keep the cocoon fully inflated. The saddle case-making caddis flies is one family, the Glossosomatidae. These are scrapers. And they also have a dome of stones, but it's manufactured during the first instar, so that all five larval instars are carrying this little dome about with them throughout their larval life. There is a ventral strap right across the middle here, and the animal is able to turn around inside that case and use either end interchangeably. They actually can advance upstream by a sort of twisting and turning of the case as they move upstream and changing ends as they go. They pupate by removing that ventral strap, cementing the dome to the rock on which they're walking, and then spin a semi-permeable cocoon inside. The third group are the purse case-making caddis flies, the Hydrotiloidea, with two families in it. Some of you may not be familiar with the Tilacolepidae, but that's recently elevated out of Hydrotiloidae. These are feeding in a number of different ways, most notably piercing herbivores, as well as scrapers and collecting gatherers. They exhibit an interesting developmental sequence in that the first four instars are free-living, like the Rhycophyllidae and Hydrobiosidae, and the fifth instar builds this purse case. It's supposed to look like a little coin purse. The abdomen of that fifth instar is very much larger proportionally than the rest of what were in the previous instars, so that we think of this as a form of hypermetamorphosis. They pupate inside these purse cases, sealing the ends of the case, and then the Hydrotiloidae spin a semipermeable cocoon, and the Tilacolepidae a porous cocoon. The tube case-making caddis flies are the suborder Integropalpia. And these also have a wide range of feeding strategies, collecting, gathering, shredding, scraping. All of the cases, you can see there's a wide range of forms, but all the cases are essentially tubular. Even when they wrap up in a coil like the Helicocycid, they're essentially tubular. And you can see they're made of all kinds of materials. The pupate inside this this case, attaching it to the substrate and sealing the ends with silk and a kind of a membrane at the end of the case on both ends. But they have no cocoon inside. We think that the case is important not only for camouflage and for physical protection of the larva, but also is a great aid in respiration in that the animal is able to direct a steady flow of oxygenated water across its body inside that case. And then finally, the retreat-making caddisflies, the suborder Annulipalpia, with, again, several different feeding strategies. Many of them are collecting filterers, but we also have predators in this group, collecting gatherers, and they usually occur in flowing water habitats. The retreats are all stationary, composed of silk, often with sand or bits of plant material incorporated in with the silk. And as I say, many of them are collecting filters, and so they will use the nets in one way or another to filter fine particulate organic matter out of the water column. They pupate inside a dome-like shelter, like the Rhacophyllidae and the Glossomatidae, but there is no cocoon inside this shelter. Through the years, there have been many different ideas about the phylogenetic relationships among these different families and family groups in Trichoptera. This is out of the Annual Review of Entomology paper that I did 11 years ago. And across the top, you'll see Hydrocycidae, Hydrotillidae, I can't read on from up here, but Philopotamidae, Hydrotillidae, Rhacophyllidae, Glossomatidae. Okay, that was Hydrobiosity over there. This is Hydrotillidae there. And then the Integropalpia families are over here. So you can see how they have been variously associated, sometimes with the middle families especially, sometimes associated with the Annulipalpia groups, sometimes associated with the Integropalpia groups, and on through the years, including this arrangement here in which the Spicipalpia, the families in the middle there, have been considered ancestral to the other two groups. So here from 1924 through 1996, you see different ideas that have been proposed. Take note particularly the arrangement of Friney and Wiggins with this grade Spicipalpia in the middle, and also the arrangement by Weaver right here, I'll refer to in just a minute, with the Spicipalpia associated with Annulipalpia. John Weaver and I, back in 1986, attempted to interpret that last one for the case-making behavior in caddisflies, indicating that the caddisflies primitively were some sort of a sub-aquatic tube-making animal down in the substrate. Integropalpia tube case-makers, the retreat-making curvipalpia, and then all of the spicipalpia groups as a monophyletic arrangement here. Glenn Wiggins, in his book that I referred to earlier, provided this illustration of the Amphismenoptera, ancestral to the Lepidoptera and Trichoptera. And he says that the primitive caddisflies were free-living animals. Here are all the saddle case makers, the free-living caddisflies, and the purse case makers here in the middle. Again, effectively a grade from which the other two suborders arose. And he refers to a ground plan, which includes a free-living larva, pupation in dome shelter, and pupation in a semipermeable cocoon. This illustration is out of the chapter by Will and Resch in the newly published Merritt et al. Edition. It's a conservative representation of the ideas of Carl Cher et al., who have used both morphological and molecular data to attempt to infer the relationships among the caddisflies. Here you see the Annulipalpia at the top. You see the Integropalpia here at the bottom. And then in the middle, as a part of a four-way polytomy, right here, the Glossosomatidae, the Rhycophyllodia, and the Hydrotiloidea in a so-called Spicapalpia group. What we wanted to do, what I wanted to do for this presentation was to interpret this for case making, you know, in much the same way that Weaver and I did back in 1986, to see if anything has changed with regard to the new arrangement that you see in this phylogeny. So this is a reduced version of the cladogram that I just showed you, with outgroups Lepidoptera, the Antliophora, the Mecoptera, Diptera, and so forth, and the Hymenoptera here. And I'm going to work from that for the remainder of the discussion. The details certainly need to be investigated, but one of the things that is, and please understand what we're doing here, I'm not inferring any phylogeny here. The phylogeny is already inferred. We're working from a given phylogeny. And the inferences that I'll share with you are going backward in time, starting out here with the tips and going back based on what we know about the tips and going back to try to infer what the ancestral conditions were. And so in any particular case, we're going to be looking for the intersection of characteristics that may be out here at the tips of the cladogram, if you understand what I'm saying. With this phylogeny, one of the things that is held in common by all of these groups is a ability to produce labial silk. Now, whether that is completely homologous or not, I can't tell you, because the physiology and the morphology of that has not been thoroughly compared. But it strikes me that this could be one other synapomorphy that would put these groups together. And it is the production of labial silk that Wiggins and Mackay some years ago suggested is probably one of the reasons that caddisflies have been so successful. Coming up the tree now, we're walking back up the tree, having inferred this now, all of this information, starting with the tips and going down. So I'm talking you back out the scenario of walking back up the tree. The Lepidoptera and the Trichoptera, in other words, the ancestor Amphismenoptera, appear to be burrowers, primitively speaking. That is to say, they are down in some kind of substrate. And I take as a basis for this hypothesis, quotation, for example, by Don Davis in Fred Steer's book, although external feeders, the larvae are secretive, preferring to burrow through thick mats of mosses and lichens or leaf litter. And then on later in the chapter, Heath in 76 indicated that larvae are known to burrow at least to 10 centimeters down in the soil. And that's in Micropterygidae, the Zeugloptera. And Dactylonypha, the larvae are all leaf miners. And in the Exoporia, the Hepialidae, I was just talking to Dave just before the paper here, larvae of some species tunnel in woody tissue, lining the tunnel with silk before spinning a cocoon for pupation. But Dave says that many of them also are burrowing in soil, apparently in much the same way. So while we have no examples in any of the Trichoptera of exactly this kind of behavior, the intersection between a retreat maker, a tube case maker, and then these more or less free-living animals that have precociously put on a dome-like shelter in their larval stages, or at least by pupation in Rhycophyllodia. The intersection seems to be a larva that is burrowing in the sediments, or in a secretive fashion perhaps, but down in the sediments. And of course, if those are wet sediments and they adapt to living in those wet sediments, then you will have an understanding of how an animal that is burrowing in the sediments, perhaps lining the burrow in which it moves with silk, can extend that burrow out onto the surface of the substrate and have it attached to the substrate with the silk, such as one of the retreat makers, or it can simply cut the material off at the back end and walk out with a tube. Coming on up, the caddisflies, one of the synaphomorphies that Wiggins recognized was the dome-like pupation shelter that is common to all of the more basal lineages of Trichoptera. The retreat-making larva is found in Annulipalpia, and this is clearly a monophyletic group, as is the Integropalpia. Free living seems to have been the common behavior for the group that includes all of the so-called Spicipalpia families and the Integropalpia. A semipermeable cocoon is known in three of those lineages, three of those four lineages, and as I say, one subfamily has a semipermeable cocoon, one does not in the Hydrotiloidea, but I show it on all three lineages here. Once this polytomy is further resolved, we may get a better idea of when that semipermeable cocoon came to be. Glenn Wiggins puts a lot of emphasis on the semipermeable cocoon and would love to see it argued back down here further toward the base, but we don't really seem to have that evidence in this phylogeny. The Glossosomatidae, as I said earlier, are building their dome precociously and transporting it around as a larva, eventually sealing it to make that pupation chamber. The Hydrotiloidea build their case somewhat differently. There's quite a range of kinds of cases in the Hydrotiloidea, but somewhat differently, but only in the fifth instar. Again, though, a precocious pupal shelter. One common thing that they do have, you notice there are two seams. Regardless of the case, these are flattened. There seem to be two seams, one on either side, much like the Glossosomatidae. So it's possible that they have some, that may be some argument for a sister relationship between those two, but again, there needs to be much more evidence to confirm that. And then the tube case making Integropalpia, with their perhaps a pupal shelter, is really hard to say whether that tube was made first for the larva or was made as a pupation device that they incorporated precociously for larval use. But in any case, they do have this tube-like larval and pupal shelter. So that's the summary of the way that we see the Trichoptera having evolved now, and particularly I emphasize this burrowing type of larva as different from Glenn's idea about a free-living larva, I think is probably the ancestral condition for Trichoptera. And with that, I'll be happy to take questions.